Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today I'm joined by Professor Andrew Chestnut, the very first Bishop Walter Sullivan Chair in Catholic Studies and a Professor of Religious Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. He was a contemporary of mine in graduate school at UCLA, where he earned his PhD in the Department of History, whereas I was over in political science. Dr. Chestnut is internationally recognized expert on Latin American religious history and has authored three critically acclaimed books: Born Again in Brazil, The Pentecostal Boom and the Pathogens of Poverty; Competitive Spirits, Latin America's New Religious Economy; and most recently, Devoted to Death, Santa Muerte, The Skeleton Saint, which will be coming out in a second edition in a few months and will be the topic of our discussion today. I should also note it has been published in Mexico and, of all places, Poland. Andrew has appeared in the popular press quite a bit as well, including writing and or being quoted in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, National Public Radio, Huffington Post, and the Ottawa Citizen. We love our Canadian listeners, so big shout out to them. You can always find out more about our guests and where to purchase their books over at our website, as well as on Facebook and Twitter. So please connect with us and tell a friend. Andrew, welcome finally to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much for having me, Professor Gill, and it's great to reconnect after more than two decades back in graduate school at UCLA.
I know, it's been 25 years, actually, so that's quite a time. I know, it goes by fast. Anyways, I want to have you on for a long time now because I'm a big fan of your first two books, and I just came across your book on the Skeleton Saint. And to find out then that it's been published in Poland. I mean, Poland? Well, how did you get published in Poland?
Yeah, that was really kind of an odd outlier. It is a press called Okultura that obviously specializes in the occult. And they didn't contact me. They went directly to my publisher, Oxford University Press. So I only found out about it after they had negotiated a contract with Oxford. I think there's kind of a robust interest in Poland and much of Eastern Europe in the occult. But yeah, I mean, it really is fascinating because recent surveys from Pew Foundation really show us that Poland is the last country left in much of Europe where Catholics actually still attend Mass, I think, at a rate of 40%. So yeah, Poland is somewhat surprising.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. It's very cool. As I find out that there's not that many Santa Muerte out there in Poland, but we'll find out where they are. Mostly the Western Hemisphere here is a little bit in Europe, Latin Europe as well, so we'll find out. I'm always interested in how my guests come up on the topics that they write about. And what is really cool about your book is that it has a very personal reveal in the opening pages. Fill us in on that, because I think it's a great lesson for younger scholars who might be struggling finding a dissertation topic, or even for some of us old folks who, you know, might be a little bit burned out on our topics.
Yeah, up until that year, 2009, when I came across Santa Muerte, I was about 2 years into a book project on the Virgin of Guadalupe, who, of course, is the most significant advocate of the Virgin Mary in the entire world. But I just wasn't finding the same level of passion that had buoyed my previous research. And so it's in that context that in March 2009, I see the news that the Mexican army goes in with bulldozers and backhoes and raises some 40 Santa Muerte shrines on the border with Texas and California. Now, I've been going to Mexico since the early 1980s, so I was aware of Santa Muerte, but it wasn't until that point that I realized that Santa Muerte had become kind of religious enemy number one. in the Mexican government's war against the narco cartels in Mexico.
It's kind of interesting, too, that you mentioned as soon as you heard that on the news, you started looking around and you'd see on the back of pickup trucks or, you know, somewhere in the back of a, you know, restaurant or something, all these different Santa Muerte votives and other, you know, stickers on cars and things like that. And, you know, after...
Yeah. I had recently moved to Richmond from Houston. I was at the University of Houston for 11 years. And so Houston has the second largest Mexican immigrant population in the country after Los Angeles. And so all over Houston, you'll see Santa Muerte in the form of decals on the back of SUVs. I could see her votive candles at the local supermarket. So yeah, she's pretty much ubiquitous in Houston. So that was kind of also a context I had before moving here to Richmond.
Yeah, and as I picked up your book too, this is something that a lot of these things are hidden in plain sight, and there's a small Mexican bodega place down by us that sells specialty foods and things like that. And all of a sudden, I noticed it there. Yeah, and I probably had been staring at it 100 times, but then all of a sudden, you're like, "Oh, my dissertation topic or my next research topic is actually sitting right there in plain sight." That sometimes we overlook it for a lot of other things, like you were saying, you know, Virgin of Guadalupe. Everybody's talking about that, so it must be the big thing. So, yeah.
Right, and of course, you know, that in my previous research, that had never happened to me. I'd always, since grad school back at UCLA, gotten on the track and stayed on it. And so it did take me a good month or so consulting with colleagues, friends, and family to decide whether or not I should at least temporarily turn my back on Guadalupe and delve into this project on Santa Muerte. So, you know, it wasn't an easy decision, especially since I'd already invested some 2 years in the Guadalupe project. But in retrospect, I'm very pleased that I did it. It's really taken me to new places, especially new audiences beyond the Ivory Tower. And, it's just been fascinating. And it's kind of the interesting thing is I somewhat rushed the first edition of the books, you know, just thinking that I'd have some competition because I really wanted to crank out the first academic book on Santa Muerte. And here, more than 5 years later, the book came out in early 2012. It remains the sole scholarly book in English on Santa Muerte. In fact, the new edition out in September will probably remain the sole academic book in English. So that surprised me.
Yeah, that's a really cool thing to have. And you said that this has taken you beyond the Ivory Tower, and it's reflected in the book and how you wrote it, because it does have very personal notes, as I mentioned, you know, how you decided to come on to this topic, but also you have these little stories about individuals. And, you know, even though it's a story about the skeleton saint, which sounds kind of creepy at first, the book really is an enjoyable read in that it highlights a lot of different aspects of this figure, some stories about how people really live out their daily faith. And it's a really uplifting book in many ways. So it's not just one of these kind of occult books or things like this, but it shows people beyond the Ivory Tower living out their faiths in ways that you might not always expect.
Well, yeah, and I was really striving to reach, you know, a larger general audience. I mean, like you, I was already full professor, and so that gives us a certain flexibility to be able to do that as well. And I also wanted to, up until that point when I started my research, pretty much all the journalistic representations of her were as Santa Muerte, as the narco saint associated with cartels and protecting the cartels in Mexico. And it quickly became apparent in my field research, both in the U.S. and Mexico, that Santa Muerte really is a multifaceted, multitasking miracle worker who performs all types of miracles. I mean, of course, one of her roles is that of narco saint, but she's also a curandera or a healer. She's also an agent of prosperity. In fact, there's kind of interesting parallels with evangelical prosperity theology as well. And so I think the overarching goal was to kind of show the multifaceted identity of Santa Muerte that you don't, at least at that point, wasn't coming through in journalistic depictions of her.
Yes, let's start fleshing out some of what we're talking about with Santa Muerte here. Find out who she is, where she can be found, all the who, what, where kind of questions. The first thing I want to start off with, though, is that you notice that she's a folk saint. And what is a folk saint?
Yeah, the Latin American religious landscape is really intriguing because on one level, of course, it's the most Catholic region on Earth, with almost 40% of all 1.3 billion Catholics on Earth residing in Latin America. Yet, for some reason, some 10,000 Catholic saints apparently aren't enough for Latin Americans, who are 69% Catholic today. And so Latin America is kind of distinct on the global religious landscape for also being home to a series of so-called folk saints. Folk saints, in most cases, are real Latin Americans who were born, lived out their lives, and often died violent, premature deaths. And then within a few years after their death, develop reputations for being miracle workers. And so people will start coming to their grave sites or wherever they happen to maybe be murdered and start asking them for favors and miracles. And so there are, for example, in Mexico, another famous folk saint is Niño Fidencio, who was actually a prominent curandero or folk healer in Mexico in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Would even perform surgeries with shards of glass. The probably most notorious folk saint in Mexico, who used to be more popular than Santa Muerte, but has been lately eclipsed by Santa Muerte, is Jesus Malverde, who I think made a cameo appearance on the TV series Breaking Bad. And so the great majority of them are real Latin Americans who lived out their lives on Latin American soil. But Santa Muerte differs in that at this point in her development, she is the very personification of death itself and is not linked to a specific Latin American woman. And so that kind of distinguishes her from most other Latin American folk saints who are tied, who have these origin stories tied to specific individuals. Santa, this might change over time, but at this point, no. And that might bestow her an even greater power in that she is seen as death itself, or I should, in this instance, death herself.
One of the things I want to ask about these folk saints, though, and kind of return to that before we get into Santa Muerte, is that with regular Catholic saints, there's a process you go through. You got to show some miracles, you get beatified, you hang around for a while, there's some, you know, discussion and voting and all that kind of stuff. How do these grassroots saints become, or I should say folk saints, become part of the culture? Is it just some people start talking about it and all of a sudden everybody does?
Exactly. It's just word of mouth, yeah. You know, mostly through family members and friends. And probably in more recent developments, in fact, it seems like there's a new folk saint right now developing in Mexico City called San Huachicolero. And he's a protective folk saint of gasoline thieves, as gasoline robbery has really taken off lately in Mexico with soaring prices because of privatization. And since, you know, we're in the day and the age of robust social media, we Americans are number one in Facebook use. Mexicans are number five. A lot of the more recent developments also spread on along the lines of social media, which has also been a really important platform for the diffusion and propagation of Santa Muerte as well.
Yeah, which is interesting. You mentioned earlier in the book too that you know the image kind of came across one of your computer screens one day, and you're like, oh, you know, I guess that's a sign I should be writing on this.
Right. And you know, there are hundreds of Facebook groups for devotees. In fact, now there's like six or seven for English speaking ones. In fact, the largest English speaking group is called Devoted to Death, named after my book. I had nothing to do with it, and now has almost 900 members. And so devotees go online and share images of their home altars, ask for advice about rituals and such. And so it's lately been a really important part of my ongoing research.
We're going to have to invite some of these folks to like our Facebook page too. So the social media connecting is
right,
very cool.
Of course, I'll be posting it in those groups, right?
Yeah. So Santa Muerte, you mentioned you traveled to Mexico a lot. You're down in Houston. We seem to think of Mexico as being the focus of all this, but it's actually found pretty extensively throughout Latin America. Give us a sense of where Santa Muerte is.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, unfortunately, we don't have any hard numbers. I've been asking Pew for several years to do a survey, but no luck so far. I estimate, and this is just kind of a guesstimate based on my 8 years of research, I estimate there might be some 10 to 12 million total devotees, with probably around 70% in Mexico, maybe 15% in the U.S., 10% in Central America, and the rest mostly in South America, but now there's also devotees in Australia, Europe, the Philippines as well. So yeah, probably a bit more than two thirds are still in Mexico, and then the U.S. and Central America would be second and third in importance. And it's just been, I mean, if my estimate of 10 to 12 million is somewhat accurate, I mean, we're just talking about lightning speed growth, because it was only in 2001 that the cult goes public. Prior to 2001, 99% of Mexicans had never even heard of Santa Muerte. And in fact, I love to tell the anecdote that my 86-year-old parents-in-law, who have lived their entire lives in the western state of Michoacan, only find out about who Santa Muerte is through my research, the gringo son-in-law's research.
Yeah.
And so, again, she only goes public in 2001. So if we're talking 10 to 12 million, I realize that there's only about 14 million Jews in the entire world after centuries, of course, of Judaism. So I think that's an interesting comparison to make.
Now, you said it went public in 2001. What does that mean, and how did that happen? Was there a news release or what?
Right. A humble quesadilla vendor in the most notorious Mexico City barrio called Tepito had received a life-size effigy of the skeleton saint from one of her sons upon early release from prison. And so she'd keep this almost 6-foot-tall statue in the back of her kitchen as she sold her quesadillas to neighbors and passers-by. And many of them, when they're purchasing the quesadillas, would spy the effigy in the back of her kitchen and kind of spontaneously make offerings of flowers, tequila, cigarettes. And the offerings just got so overwhelming in her little quesadilla kitchen that with her husband, they decide to set the effigy out on the sidewalk and make a little kind of glass niche attached to the exterior wall of their home. And this was on Halloween 2001. And so this kind of marks the outing of the skeleton, the transition from what really had been a cult devotion to the very public devotion that it is today. Her name is Enriqueta Romero, fondly known as Doña Queta. She's in her mid-70s, and her husband was murdered 6 months ago by a couple motorcycle assassins in an early morning assassination 6 or 7 months ago.
Wow.
So she's a widow.
Now you're talking about this effigy, 6-foot effigy. That's a big, that's something you can't miss very easily. What does it look like? And we're in audio format here, but if you could kind of give us a description of what it is, and we'll put up pictures on our Facebook and Twitter page as well to give you a flavor for what it looks like. But
well, I think really the best description is the Grim Reaper, a female version of the European Grim Reaper. There have been some significant kind of modifications in her iconography over the past 5 years especially, but traditionally she looks like a female version of the European Grim Reaper. Her most important accoutrements being the scythe, just like the iconic Grim Reaper, the scales of justice. In fact, the oldest known representation of Santa Muerte in Mexico, the only accoutrement she has with her is the scales of justice. Also the hourglass of time, and she's often accompanied by an owl. The owl symbolizing both wisdom, but also in Native American lore, both in Mesoamerica and farther north in North America, the owl foretells impending death. So, but yeah, there's been a lot of modifications, kind of in accord with kind of the overarching form of Mexican nationalism, which tends to elevate the pre-Columbian Aztec and Mayan past. More recent developments in her iconography have kind of refashioned her as the Aztec death goddess Mictlantecuhtli. In fact, a lot of Mexicans who pondered her possible origins will tell you that Santa Muerte really is the latest incarnation of this Aztec death goddess Mictlantecuhtli. Historical research kind of shows that there's really no evidence of that, but that jibes with Mexican nationalism, which prefers pre-Columbian indigenous past to anything Spanish. So when I go to Mexico and give talks about Santa Muerte's Spanish origins, a lot of Mexicans don't want to hear about that.
Yeah. We're going to cover the origins here in a second, but a question again on the visualization of the saint or the iconography. Does it vary by region? You mentioned this is now in the Philippines, it's down in Argentina and Paraguay. Do they change up things, or is it pretty much scales of justice, owl, and the whole shebang?
There's just so much personalization lately. And so, you know, a lot of people will dress her as they see fit. Lately, she used to be mostly bald. Lately, she usually has very long locks. And at first, those locks were black. But now I see blonde and red and all kinds of pastel colors. So as her cult has grown and expanded, so too has the growth of diversity of representations as well. Going down to South America, you know, there are two other skeleton saints. In Argentina and Paraguay, there's Santa Muerte, and then in Guatemala, there's Rey Pascual. And the interesting difference there is they're represented as male figures, and they tend to be much more austerely represented than Santa Muerte, who has all of her different dresses. And actually, at her famous shrine in Tepito with Enriqueta Romero, each, on the first day of each month, she gets a wardrobe change, much kind of in the same fashion that Mexicans and other Latin Americans will dress up the various advocations of the Virgin Mary.
In addition to the diversity of looks in that, there's also a diversity of names, and reading through your book, you refer to them at different times, and it's kind of, I have to keep a little scorecard. What are some of the nicknames?
Yeah, so many monikers for her, and I'll tell you some of the most popular ones. I think my favorite is Bony Lady, and of course these are translations because they're usually going to be in Spanish. There's Bony Lady, Bald Lady, Skinny Girl, White Girl, Pretty Girl, Powerful Lady, Lady of the Shadows, White Sister, Badass, or La Chingona in Spanish. So interesting, you put some of these together and you get like Skinny White Girl or White Skinny Girl or Powerful White Skinny Girl. So yeah, and those are just some of the more common ones. I could probably put together a list of some 40 different nicknames that she has, and many of them are kind of terms of endearment. and very familiar forms, and some actually are kind of fictive kin, white sister, white godmother.
You mentioned the origins of this saint, that, you know, early on folk saints usually die some kind of terrible death and then start to perform miracles afterwards. What do we know about the history of Santa Muerte? Who is she? Where did she come from?
Great. Well, the first mention in the Mexican historical record comes twice in the 1790s in the annals of the Inquisition, in which on two separate occasions in the present day states of Guanajuato and Querétaro, inquisitors are called out to check on indigenous people who have been reported to be venerating a skeletal figure that they're actually calling Santa Muerte. And in both cases, it happens to be true. And in both cases, the inquisitors smash the idol and shut down worship of this heretical saint. Again, this is at the end of the Spanish colonial era, 1790s. And then, as far as we know, there's no further mention of Santa Muerte in the Mexican historical record for about a century and a half until she appears again in the 1940s. In the field notes of mostly American anthropologists doing field work down in Mexico who come across her in various points of the Mexican Republic. And from the 1940s to the 1980s, the only type of miracles that the anthropologists report Santa Muerte doing are love magic related, mostly for Mexican women dressed in black, asking Santa Muerte to go after their badly behaving husbands or boyfriends who they believe to be cheating on them, and to remove the cheating woman from their path and to bring back their man humbled to their feet. In fact, the oldest known prayer is exactly this type of prayer, a love prayer, asking for the return of the wayward man and for the removal of the adulterous woman from the path. In fact, a lot of different colored candles, which aren't necessarily red, which the red candle being associated with love and passion, will have this oldest known love prayer printed on the back. Going back further, it's probably the case that the Catholic Church brings over the figure of the Grim Reapress, and I say Grim Reapress because in Spain, usually it really was a female Grim Reapress called La Parca. The Catholic Church brings over La Parca, the Grim Reapress, as a tool of evangelization of the indigenous people, because obviously the Spanish, the Europeans, had no idea at the first who they were dealing with. They had no idea that the indigenous people already have many death deities in many parts of the Americas. So they bring over the Grim Reapers as a tool of evangelization. And it appears that in certain points of Latin America, like the cases I just mentioned, the indigenous people interpret the Grim Reapers through their own cultural and religious lens and end up converting what really was just kind of our artistic representation of death for the Europeans into Santa Muerte, this holy miracle-working folk saint. So what I'm really pointing at is kind of syncretism between indigenous beliefs and death deities and the Spanish Grim Reapers.
And as you noted, it changes quite a bit. It's a very dynamic process of how this saint gets represented, and we've seen it change quite a bit in just the past decade or so. But
Again, because there really wasn't much alteration to her iconography since she really was a figure of the occult up until 2001. Keeping in mind that Mexico is home to the second largest Catholic population, and as you and your pioneering work know, that there's been great Catholic hemorrhaging going back to the 1960s. Mexico's one of the countries where Catholicism, to some extent, has held its own, with about 81% still being Catholic. So this is the context of a very Catholic Mexico in which if you're venerating a figure of death, you better keep it underground.
Now, you mentioned these candles here, and part of the devotion to Santa Muerte is the lighting of candles. And your book, interestingly, breaks down the chapters into these seven monocolored votives. And then at the end, you have this polychromatic candle, which actually does exist, and I've seen pictures of that. Actually, I've seen it on shelves. You use this to explore how people use the folk saint, which is really neat. That's the bulk of the book, of how people live their daily spirituality through this folk saint. So let's walk through some of those, and let's start with the most malevolent looking one, the black votive. That's kind of the occult version that everybody tends to think of if they ever hear this. So what is this black votive all about, and what's the importance of the candles, by the way, too?
Yeah. So historically, there were three different colors, the black one, the red one of love and passion, and the white one of thanksgiving and gratitude. So it really probably was just sometime in the late 90s or as the cult becomes public that we start to have these different colors that you mentioned. The black is for protection. Supernatural protection from enemies and rivals, but it's also for those who want to do injury or harm to rivals and enemies. So you can imagine that the black candle would be particularly popular among the criminal element, particularly narcos in Mexico. Who are looking to take out rival drug traffickers and law enforcement as well. So, as I think I point out in the book, publicly, it's probably the rarest candle that you'll see, because there's probably still that stigma, especially in Mexico, that if you're working with black, you might want to do it under the cover of darkness or in the privacy of your own home.
How about the white candle? That's, I guess, the bestseller and the most monochromatic candle that you actually see.
Yeah, that's for Thanksgiving, consecration, also used for healing as well. And still, at least in Mexico, one of the most visible candles. You'll see it at public altars, roadside shrines. Because, you know, I don't want to overstate the importance of color as well. I mean, sometimes people, particularly who are new to the devotion, aren't even familiar with the color symbolism. And so they'll just buy whatever candle seems to be available. So white is purity, consecration, thanksgiving, and the most visible publicly.
Give us some examples of actually how this has been used. You tell a lot of really interesting stories, of, you know, such about the massive death or the death in the City of Angels in your book. How does the white candle play out, and how do you use the candles, actually, these votives?
Usually, if people are going to have a home altar, the most basic thing that they'll have is a candle, because, you know, in Mexico, they usually only cost $1 to $2. And so, in an economy of scarcity, many people can't even afford to buy a little figurine or statuette. And so, for some people, their home altar really is nothing more than a candle. You know, a lot of the rituals and the way that, particularly Mexicans go about approaching Santa Muerte is all predicated on their folk Catholicism. And so, there's the Santa Muerte. In fact, the epic kind of, communal worship service is called the Santa Muerte Rosary Service, which of course is just a kind of slight adaptation of the rosary prayer dedicated to the Virgin Mary. There's the Santa Muerte Novena. So yeah, a lot of that is based on folk Catholicism. Of course, you spent time in Latin America, and you know that that votive candles are also an important part of the way that people give thanksgiving and make petitions to the saints and the Virgin of Guadalupe as well. So Santa Muerte isn't innovating in terms of using employing votive candles, although the color-coded system is different. So yeah, but there's also, you know, influence by charismatic Catholics and the influence of Pentecostalism. There's just a lot of, kind of free form, personal petitions to Santa Muerte as well. It's not all kind of based on set formulaic Catholic prayers either. So, you know, with some 10 to 12 million, devotees, there's a fair amount of variety in the way that people go about venerating and approaching. But again, in the Mexican context, it's really predicated and very similar to the same forms in which devotees would approach Catholic saints.
Now, one of the things that I'm curious about, I Googled these calendars or these candles in to see what they look like. And one thing, and again, this is something that you see in plain sight all the time, but you never really think about it. And as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking more about it. A lot of these candles are in jars, and the jar has the image. It's usually a fairly tall jar, maybe 7-8 inches in height and that, and then it'll have the image of the saint on. You see a lot of these for the Virgin of Guadalupe, and now I'm starting to see more for Santa Muerte. Is there something about the tall candles or candles in glass that is important, or is it just that's how they make them?
No, yeah, that's just borrowing that from the tradition of Catholicism in Latin America. And the cheapest ones tend to be really noxious, made of, a very cheap, not even wax, but other more foul smelling substances. So these cheaper candles, you don't even want to try lighting up. But yeah, that's, again, they're just borrowing from what Catholicism has done with those jar candles, for decades.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Have you actually seen any of these, rituals performed, or is it just kind of a, we do it for a few minutes and, I light the white candle and I'm hoping for, good things to happen, some protection for me or something, or is can it actually be a lot more involved in the process of this?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's variety. There's actual kind of worship services that are fairly similar to a Catholic mass, where you have all different types of prayers, testimonies, and such. And then you have just, simple petitions where somebody might come up to an effigy of Santa Muerte, usually with some kind of offering in tow, like a bottle of tequila, and set down the tequila at Santa Muerte's feet, maybe light a red candle and make their petition. So it usually doesn't involve complex, formulaic rituals. Although it's interesting, it seems like a fair amount of American devotees, particularly white American devotees, are kind of interested in trying to go down that path, even though it's not a major path in Mexico. So it's also important to keep in mind that, again, it's only existed for 15 years as a public devotion, and there is no one official church of Santa Muerte. And so there's a great variety of devotional practice. Mexicans also are heavily influenced by New Age religiosity. So there's a lot of talk of karma and vibes and even Santa Muerte chakras. I think there are some efforts at institutionalization as well. And I think that also involves trying to decouple a lot of devotional practice from its folk Catholic roots, which is not an easy task, again, in the second largest Catholic population on earth.
Well, I can imagine. Let's Let's go ahead and go back to some of these other colored candles too, just to review what they do and how they're used. Another one is brown. What does brown candle signify?
Brown is for enlightenment and insight. And so I think that's why I put it as chapter one, the shining the light on the rather kind of murky history of the cult. It's not one of the most popular colors. In fact, I really don't see it much. And again, let me tell you that I don't want to overemphasize the importance of color. For example, brown just seemed to make the most sense for the first chapter and such. But again, it's not really an important color. And again, there's a fair amount of devotees who aren't even aware of the different color symbols. And in fact, I've seen devotional leaders, have divergences in which color symbolizes what as well. So, I don't want to overemphasize the importance of the different colors.
You say that, but all the chapters are organized by the colors, which is kind of cool.
Right. I know that's true. I know. And it was the natural organic device to do that.
And it's actually a really cool way of actually organizing it. So
it just seemed the natural way when I started, you know, delving into this. And I think it also points to one of the primary reasons for her great popularity, because a lot of the Catholic saints are usually associated with one or two particular type of miracles that they specialize in, like Saint Anthony helping you find your lost cell phone or whatever you've lost lately. But Santa Muerte does it all. She is the multifaceted, multitasking miracle worker who covers all bases. And that's what I really loved about kind of concluding with this seven color jar candle, because it kind of brings together that kaleidoscope of colors. And lots of people, particularly in Mexico today, Mexico so beset by narco violence and, you know, violence in terms of absolute numbers, which is second only in the world to Syria. Lots of Mexicans are obviously looking for multiple miracles, not just one type of miracle.
Yeah. One of the other ones that is important in this, I think, deals with some of the iconography of the scales of justice as well as the green candle or that part of the multicolored candle, and that's justice. How does this factor into the Santa Muerte cult?
I think it's of just supreme importance. And again, the first accoutrement that we see her in, her first representation, is those scales of justice. And Mexico, particularly during the decade-long drug war, is a place of great injustice, great impunity. Only about 2% of murders end up in any kind of conviction, which is basically a license to kill. A lot of Mexicans are so afraid to even report crimes, fearing that they'll go into their local police station and be accused of being part of the crime that they're reporting. The Mexican judicial system is dysfunctional, maybe at best. And so Santa Muerte has really become the patroness, the patron saint of the entire Mexican penal system, not just of Mexican prisoners, but also of prison guards, of social workers, the entire penal system. She's also really popular in the prisons here in Texas, Southwest U.S., and in California as well. So I think also that persona in which she's non-judgmental. She really acts more as a kind of supernatural lawyer or advocate for those who have been wronged and trying to get them the best deal, and not so much as, despite, you know, having those scales of justice, not so much serving as a judge, but as an advocate. So also in Mexico or Latin America in general, increasingly our country as well, so beset by these great inequalities in wealth and income, that leveling scythe that she wields is also very appealing, knowing that ultimately that scythe is going to take billionaire Carlos Slim as well with them, I think provides some measure of kind of compensation to a lot of devotees who tend to be mostly working class.
Okay. Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question about in terms of who the devotees are. You mentioned just now working class. Is there highly concentrated in the poor barrios, or does it extend across all socioeconomic classes?
Yeah, again, I wish, you know, we don't really have that data, and let's blame that on Pew for the moment.
Yeah, okay.
But again, from my 8 years of research, while she does have a following among the middle class and upper middle class, I would definitely say she tends to be more concentrated in working class neighborhoods, and you know, the real kind of epicenter of her devotional activity is again that infamous barrio of Tepito in Mexico City. And if you go in some of the more popular barrios of Mexico City, she really is ubiquitous in terms of street shrines, people wearing her t-shirts, graffiti on the walls. She really is everywhere. That's just my own research and stuff. Again, we don't have any systematic surveys yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of opportunities for graduate students here, sociology of religion.
Exactly.
And that, you know, this
exactly.
is one of the cool things about doing research is that sometimes you're left with a lot more questions than the answers you get, and that's always, always, always opportunities for everybody to study this more.
And again, this is the fastest growing new religious movement in the entire Americas. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, particularly those students who might be interested in new religious movements and such, there's a lot more to be done on Santa Muerte. And actually, I'm moving on to a new research project. So I suppose just like I've never been able to leave Pentecostalism behind totally, I'm not going to be spending full time on Santa Muerte as of this summer.
Yeah. So there you go, graduate students. Andrew just left a treasure trove
leaving
of opportunity.
The door open, right.
Exactly, and that's a cool thing to do. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is an interesting figure who made the news related to this, a guy named David Romo. What's his story, and how did this affect the imagery of the cult of Santa Muerte?
Wow, yeah, the figure of David Romo is so fascinating. He founded the first Santa Muerte temple in Mexico City in 2003, actually obtained legal recognition as a religious group in Mexico, but that legal status only lasted for 2 years, because under pressure from the Catholic Church, the Vicente Fox administration revoked the temple's legal status in 2005. He continued to run the church, but without, you know, the perks and privileges of being a legally recognized religious group. And then in 2011, was arrested, charged, and convicted for being the money man for a kidnapping ring in Mexico City that specialized in kidnapping elderly folks, and was given a sentence of 66 years, and so he's probably close to 60, so he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And his wife continues to run the temple, but last time I heard, attendance is pretty sparse, and it's been eclipsed by other groups. But during the time that he was active on the Santa Muerte scene, from 2003 to the time of the arrest, he was the main spokesperson for devotion in Mexico, was very aggressive and belligerent, in kind of taking on both the the PAN, the right-wing political party that was in power at the time, and the Catholic Church as well. In fact, at one point, he even used the word jihad in calling for jihad against the Catholic Church because he really saw the Catholic Church as the architect of the revocation of his legal status as well. I can't tell you whether or not the charges against him were legitimate, because we know that in Latin America sometimes these things are fictitious, but he's kind of faded off the scene as he's in jail now.
And just an interesting question on him. The name Roma, when I first read it in your book, and I hadn't heard about this guy getting arrested, or if I did, it never registered. When I heard Romo, I obviously went to Tony Romo from the, you know, Dallas Cowboys.
right.
Yeah, probably no relation. I thought, well, maybe he's the devotee for, you know, trying to get the Cowboys to finally make the playoffs or something. is he a native born Mexican, or did he come from abroad? Is he like a Jim Jones character kind of
guy? He's Mexican.
Okay.
He's not from Mexico City, but he's Mexican. Yeah. Yeah. Both Roma and Romero are fairly common surnames in Mexico. He actually spent some time when he was a kid in Los Angeles. I think he even flirted with Jehovah's Witnesses and such. And so the official name of the church was, USA Mexico Apostolic Catholic Church or something. So, he was very fond of the few years that he spent in Los Angeles, and his temple actually strange for the Mexican context, had an American flag alongside the Mexican flag there as well. But yeah, he was a real pioneer in being the spokesperson for the cult, but obviously with his conviction and long jail sentence, he's no longer on the scene.
I want to finish up here with a reflection question, looking backwards a little bit, then also one that is forward-looking. Let's start with the backwards-looking one. You've been studying Latin American religiosity for a long time now, and you know, we old folks, I think we've come to learn that research is not so much coming up with a set of firm results, but it's more of a journey where we learn things along the way. And I'm always interested in asking my guests who've been around for a while, is there anything throughout the research process dating back a quarter of a century or more now? That sounds like a long time, quarter of a century. Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
I should have just a couple decades. Anyways, is there anything that you've learned that's changed your mind about how you view the world, or that's really surprised you about the human condition?
Oh, that's a fantastic question, Tony, and one that I've done a lot of interviews on Santa Muerte over the past 5 years, and that's the first time I get that question. Of course, it had to be from a fellow academic, right?
Right.
I would say. Kind of the connecting thread in my two decades of research has been the paramount importance of faith healing. I started with Pentecostalism in Brazil, made the argument that Pentecostalism is thriving mostly because of its great emphasis on faith healing. And then kind of following your lead, when I looked at religious competition on the Latin American religious landscape, it really seems to be those religious groups and enterprises that really kind of put faith healing front and center that are most thriving. And one of the great surprises about delving into Santa Muerte was, who knew, but one of her most important roles is that of curandera, or faith healing. In fact, three of the candles, and one way of the votive candles, in one way or the other, the purple, which is the main one associated with Santa Muerte healing. But then there's also the yellow one for people suffering addiction, particularly drug addiction and alcoholism. And then the white one also stands in for healing as well. And so that, I just find that fascinating, that in this world of popular Latin American religiosity, faith healing in whatever form. And we can also see there's also been a boom in exorcism, both Catholic and Pentecostal exorcism. And we can also view that as kind of a form of faith healing as well. And so, although it's not always explicit and maybe less explicit in my Santa Muerte research, I'd say that's kind of been the one great connecting thread, and it has not always been an intentional thread that I've tried to connect either, but there it is. And so, you know, I could, if I wanted, do a whole project on faith healing. Obviously, there's other scholars who work that very well as well. But yeah, that the whole paramount importance of faith healing is what really stays at me after 2 decades of doing this.
So in terms of mentioning you could do a whole project on faith healing, that brings up the last question I have for you, which is future projects. What direction are you going in now? You mentioned that you're going to be taking up something new. Give us a little preview.
Yeah, well, again, I do hold a chair in Catholic studies, and obviously, or I shouldn't say obviously, but, you know, without Catholicism, there is no Santa Muerte. Santa Muerte never could have arisen in a Protestant context, such as in the United States or in Northern Europe. And so my next project is going to look at various facets of Catholic death culture, like relics, charnel houses in Europe, ossuaries, incorruptible bodies of saints, Day of the Dead in Mexico, and also probably more examination of, I mentioned there's these other death saints in Argentina and Guatemala, maybe closer examination of them as well. So yeah, Catholic death culture in the West is the subject of my next project.
All right. Yeah, I said that was the last question, but I have one more because you prompted something in my mind, and it's the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. You just said that Santa Muerte could not have arisen in a Protestant culture. Why?
Because there's this connection with relics of holy bones.
Yeah.
And just, you know, using the figure of the Grim Reaper, so the Grim Reaper really was the province of the Catholic, as a tool of evangelization, really was the province of the Catholic Church. And, the iconography, the saints, and it's just really anathema to at least the historical way that Protestantism has played out. And I would say we don't hear it as much, but in a way, in fact, the earliest feature-length film on Santa Muerte was made by an evangelical Mexican filmmaker, Paco del Toro, in kind of Mexican soap opera style, to show Santa Muerte as a demonic deceiver in her miracles. And so I would say there's been kind of even greater condemnation on the part of evangelicals in Mexico. But of course, you know, they're only about 10 to 15% of the population. So it's usually the Catholic denunciation that come through louder and clearer.
Well, an interesting link there to our Protestant Reformation series that we're featuring all this year, so I had to put that plug in there. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, some really fascinating stuff that you've been doing over the many decades that you've been working on this stuff, and many more interesting things to be coming. My guest today has been Andrew Chestnut. Andrew, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
It's been a pleasure, Tony, reconnecting, and thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.